Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to Guilty Pleasures, the show where we celebrate the movies we love despite what critics, public opinion, or even our own God-given sense might tell us. I'm your host, Lou Hare, for the Front Row Network, and welcome to a special episode, a special crossover episode. So for those of you who have been listening to the main feed, you may have heard me a few times in the past discuss two of my favorite movies of all time, which is The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two. Well, tonight, we are going to complete the trilogy, but since we are talking about a movie that is definitely not a classic, we have now crossed over and brought the classics team into the guilty pleasure realm, so we can talk all about The Godfather Part 3, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Next month, it was released on Christmas Day, but wow. Why are we not doing it on Christmas Day? Well, there's a couple of reasons, and we will get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to introduce our panel, the hosts of Classics. I am thrilled that they are here to complete this journey with me. First off, Mr. Brandon Davis. How's it going, Brandon?
Hey, Lou. So this is how it ends, with a whimper.
It does. With a slumped over man, slumped over diabetic with an orange. That's how it ends. All right.
Yeah, man.
And rounding out the co-host of Classics, Mr. Eric Fleck. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well. Glad to be here. Glad to be talking about a movie that was made, you know, when I was alive. So yes. This is fun. This is different.
Yeah, yeah. That's got to be an interesting change of pace, at least.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. So for those of you who are not familiar with The Godfather Part 3, just a quick line summary, and then we'll there's lots to get into. But just so you know, Godfather 3 picks up in 1979, where we follow an aging, guilt-ridden Michael Corleone as he seeks redemption for his soul, but finds himself drawn into the crime world one last time. It is written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, who did the first two films, obviously, with a screenplay with Mario Puzo. And it brings back as many of the original cast as they could get. Not all. There's one particularly glaring omission we will talk about. But so at the center of this movie is Al Pacino reprising his role as Michael Corleone, Diane Keaton returning as Kay, Talia Shire returning as Connie, and then two newcomers to the cast, Andy Garcia and Sofia Coppola, the daughter of Francis Ford Coppola, in a pivotal role. And yeah, we're going to have some thoughts on that one too.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we've got a ton of backstory on this movie, but before we get into all of that, I want to talk about, I know the two of you are big fans of the Godfather series, as am I. Tell me a little bit about your experience with the third Godfather movie, because I felt this way kind of when we had I had the discussion earlier this year talking about Rocky V, that there are some people who maybe like didn't come around to it because you had heard bad things. Were you one of those people, or were you like right on board from the jump? Were you in that initial group that saw it right away? Eric, let's start with you.
Yeah, so the weird thing, when I say that this movie was made when I was alive, I was like 14 when it was made. So I remember this one coming out. I was a little too young to see it in the theaters. But I remember the reaction a lot of people having to this one was not venom. They were like, should have left well enough alone. And, you know, did we really need this one? So that's the mindset I had going into it. And honestly, it's the mindset I had coming out of my first viewing of it too, was, okay. Doesn't live up to the first two. Very hard to live up to the first two. But this one just doesn't. And there's a lot of reasons it doesn't work. If you look at it on paper and you see Michael Corleone and aging gets drawn back into the criminal underworld one last time. You bring back all of these players. On paper, this thing should work. It should work better than it does. But it, there's some flaws to it, some fatal flaws that just make it just an okay movie. There's parts that are great, but there's a lot of parts too that fall flat on their face.
Mm-hmm. All right, Brandon, how about you?
By the time I came to this, it was, by the time I was old enough to get to this, you know, there had been enough lore around it where I just kind of stayed away from it for a long time. And I really, let's see, I think the first time I watched it was probably 5-6 years ago, I'm thinking. Really, I stayed away from it for a long time. And I think so much, I think so much had been built up about it that, you know, I was expecting a lot worse than what I got, which I think was good. But to me, it felt like moments of greatness. And then there are times where it just feels like a TV reunion movie from the 90s where they couldn't get the whole cast back. So they're trying to fill in parts that sort of fill the void of what you liked about the originals. And it just, this is a movie where definitely parts are greater than the whole. Mm-hmm. And the whole, for some reason, I don't know. I know that Coppola intended for this to be kind of like a eulogy, but I think it really goes into full funeral mode most
yeah,
of the time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that too. We're gonna air. It's not Festivus yet, but I'm gonna air some grievances with Mr. Coppola tonight. But yeah, I'm with you, Brandon. I was about 11 years old when this came out. It was not on my radar of something I needed to see. I clearly, you know, I didn't even watch the first Godfather movie till I was in high school. And by that point, the reputation of the third one had preceded it. But to draw to your point, Eric, I remember because I started getting dialed into like watching the Oscars at that age and, you know, paying attention to reviews. And, you know, it sounded like a big prestige movie because, you know, by the way, we're gonna trash on this movie, but it's also, this is the most prestigious movie I think Guilty Pleasures will ever cover. I don't think can get bigger than this because this movie still managed to be nominated for 7 Academy Awards. Gonna say right off the bat, it rides the coattails of those first two movies. Those are all legacy nominations as far as I'm concerned, but we'll get into that. But yeah, but then when I heard the reputation, I think when the DVD set finally came out, I owned all three now. And I was like, well, now that I own all three, I should watch this third one. And to draw back to your point, Brandon, it was like, by that point I was expecting such a mess that I think I, you know, gave it much more of a pass. So I was like, oh, this isn't as good as the other two, but it's not awful. And then I watched it again for this podcast. And I'm going to leave it at that because I think we're going to dive into lots of different stuff. But so let's give you a little bit of a background here on where we're at. So Godfather Part 2 happens in 1974. It follows up. So Godfather 1 is 72. This is 74. We jump ahead now 16 years before we get the third one. And a lot has happened in those 16 years. Namely, Francis Ford Coppola had tried to disavow himself from doing the Godfather series, wanted to walk away from the series, period. And so that's why it took so long for this movie to happen. And it only happens because Coppola opens a movie studio and has a couple of pretty notorious flops, and he needs the money. So much like Michael Corleone, every time he thinks he's out, they pull him back in. Yeah. And that's how we get this movie. This Paramount demanded this movie, but then they put some demands on him, which we'll get to. And yeah, the results aren't great. This movie makes $66 million off a $54 million budget. So it barely makes a profit stateside. Now, to give that some context, here are the adjusted totals for all three movies. Godfather 1 is the highest grossing movie of the year and one of the highest grossing films of all time. By today's standards, it makes upwards of $739 million, which, by the way, is also just a sidebar. Insane when you think of a 3-hour epic movie
right,
that isn't a Marvel movie, you know?
Right. And didn't you and I, we talked about the second highest grossing movie that year was Poseidon Adventure,
oh, good
which
Lord,
couldn't
yes.
be more different.
Yeah, exactly. One of them has stood the test of time slightly better. as you can tell, because Godfather is in Brandon's Classics thread and Poseidon Adventure is in my Guilty Pleasures thread. So, but yeah, and it wins tons of Oscars. And then 2 years later, Godfather 2 comes out. It makes $238 million in adjusted box office. So less money, but still a success, still wins lots of awards. Godfather 3 makes $148 million by 2020 standards. So not like a bomb. But I mean, clearly almost, you know, half of what the previous one had made. And then the reviews show the same thing. The Rotten Tomatoes score is 68% as opposed to 98% for 1 and 2. And the IMDb score is 7.6 as opposed to 9.2 for the original and 9.0 for the second one. So, wow. There we have it. Yeah, so clearly a bit of a fall from grace. So let's just dive into it, and let's start with the center of this film. Let's start with Michael Corleone himself, Al Pacino. And, you know, I think maybe you mentioned it, I think you mentioned it, Eric, about, you know, on paper, this sounding like a good idea. So let's talk about what did you like about the story of Michael Corleone this first time for Godfather 3?
You know, I do like the effort to parallel his story to the other two Godfather stories, to have him sort of go on a similar journey that his father went on. And I like the fact that there's a redemption arc for this character too. I mean, he's getting to the end of his career and thinking about what he's actually going to leave behind. Those things all should work pretty well. And they do, for the most part. He's probably the best part of this movie. I like Al Pacino acting as more Michael Corleone. You know, you get a lot of that in those first two movies, and he's great at it. He's still not kind of crazy Pacino that we sort of see post Sin of a Woman, where he's resting on his laurels a little bit and yelling a lot at the screen. So this is it's not as great as his Godfather 1 and 2 performances, but it's a good performance from Al Pacino too.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, how about you?
Yeah, I echo what Eric said. I think it's an interesting parallel, because to go from, you know, Vito's arc all the way down to Michael's arc, where, you know, Vito leaves Italy, comes to America, you know, makes a family, you know, so he starts out alone and ends up dying, you know, a man with people around him, whereas, you know, Michael is born into a family of privilege and everything, and then ends up dying alone where his father fled from. So it's that interesting sort of arc right there, but yeah, it was a good idea on paper, and I think that Pacino works well with what he's given. I know that you alluded when you all discussed Dick Tracy earlier this year that this was the same year, and so mm-hmm. that these are kind of two signposts in Pacino's career, and there are wonderful moments in this movie where he is really, I believe it's an older Michael Corleone. And then there are some moments where it does feel like Kabuki theater. There's a couple of scenes, a couple of scenes in particular, but I think he does well with what he's given. You know, you can't lay it all in any of the actors' feet in this movie, because I don't think the script is up to par with mm-hmm. what they were given in the previous two films. But with what most of these actors are given, they do rise to the occasion, and Pacino included.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's where I was going. You brought up Dick Tracy, and it having Dick Tracy so fresh in my mind, because we just did it for Guilty Pleasures a couple months ago, because it also celebrated its 30th anniversary. The thought that went through my head was, which one of these did he film first? Because there were moments where his cadence and he sounded still kind of like Big Boy. And I don't think that's the, and I don't mean that as a compliment,
right.
in this context, because the thing that always strikes me when I watch this movie, and it struck me even more, is this Michael Corleone that we're seeing. And I know he's aged, but he doesn't sound like Michael anymore. And I know some of that's Pacino's voice got gravelier as he got older. But if you go back and you watch those first two movies, there's no gravelly sound in his voice. So it's like, did, like, you know, did he go real hard on the smokes in those 20 years? And so he's got, like, he doesn't sound like Michael. His hair, I don't know what he's doing with that hair. Like the spike, the spike haircut, which I don't know if that was a style in the in 1979.
I mean, it doesn't live in the 70s. It doesn't really live in the 90s. It is kind of an odd choice there.
Coppola does take credit for that choice in the audio commentary on the Blu-ray I have. He does.
Oh.
He cut, and apparently he cut it himself. So
he takes credit for this?
Like, yes, he thinks he does.
He was happy with this look?
Yeah, he said an older Michael Corleone at this point would not have the, you know, flowing locks that Al Pacino would have, apparently. So it was a directorial choice, but yeah, I don't understand it.
Okay. I mean, if it, as far as egregious choices go in this movie, it's not even top five, so fine, but but yeah, that's the thing that strikes me, and I hear what you're both saying, because Pacino, I think Pacino's a great actor, and even bad Pacino is still watchable, and I don't think we're into the hammy Pacino. So yeah, he's a good it's a good performance, but it just seems so disconnected from the first, from the Michael that we've seen in the others. And I know they're trying the time gap, I think they're trying to use as a crutch in that, but we never really get to see it. And it's Michael Corleone, like, wallowing for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Is the other part about it. He's got, and that's maybe the one of the things I think we can get to now is when we're talking about the ensemble, is he doesn't really have anybody to bounce off of. You know, what strikes me about this movie is this has such a non-distinct secondary cast. Every time I watch this movie, I'm like, oh, yeah, Joe Mantegna is in this. Eli Wallach is in this. Bridget Fonda is in this. Like, gun to my head, if you'd had asked me earlier this week, hey, is Bridget Fonda in Godfather 3? I'd be like, no, of course. But I forget it every time. But
same. I was surprised when she came on screen. Yeah. I was like, oh, my, she's in this?
Yeah, and I agree with that, because the other two movies have huge ensemble casts, mm-hmm. and I can picture in my head, if you mentioned me a character, I could picture them in my head. Mm-hmm. In this movie, it's kind of like Air, some of the supporting cast. It just mm-hmm. goes through you, and you can't even, I remember that George Hamilton is in this movie, and yet he does nothing of consequence in the entire movie.
Yeah, I can never forget that George Hamilton's in this movie because it's maybe the you brought him up, so let's talk about it. Yes, George Hamilton, tan, if for our listeners who haven't seen this movie, the George Hamilton that you probably know from commercials and the joking about his, you know, overly tan figure or whatever. Yes, that George Hamilton is in this movie basically replacing Robert Duvall.
Yeah. It's an odd substitute.
It's like trading like a fine steak for an overly charred cheap $3 steak.
The problem is too, like, why does that character even need to be there? You know, Tom is gone, mm-hmm. and they don't even give Hamilton that much to do. They give him this role as concierge, and he doesn't do anything except have a few scenes of acting annoyed and ticked off, and it just doesn't move the plot along at all. I don't understand the choice at all.
No, he's a glorified yes man. He has no functional purpose to the plot. To expand on this a little bit, so Robert Duvall was originally asked, and you know, there's the folklore behind this movie, I think, is way more interesting than the movie itself.
No, absolutely.
I think we could do a documentary about Godfather 3, and it would probably be more interesting than this film. But the story is that Robert Duvall was offered $1 million to come to reprise his role as Tom Hagen. And the one of the earlier drafts of the script had a storyline where basically Tom Hagen was going to betray Michael. He was going to rat him out. He was going to be an informant. And that's, I mean, that story completely tracks with the story of Tom throughout, because Tom's repeatedly treated like trash.
Yeah.
Throughout. So like, I'm like, ooh, that would have been good. Duvall sat out. He balked at coming back because he learned that he would be making 1/5 of what Al Pacino was making, which was $5 million. He'd be making less than what Diane Keaton was being offered at $1.5 million. So he sat out. He wanted more money. The studio said, nope, this is it. And so he sat out. He's like, okay, peace out. You need me more than I need you at this point. And I'm sure because it's Duvall, he had some probably more colorful ways of putting that. So they don't get him and they replace him. Basically, they have to rewrite him out and replay, you know, they do a line off the top about how Tom has passed away.
It's a throwaway line for a character that meant so much to the first two movies. They should have had a whole like section devoted to at least, you know, the effect of Tom's death on everybody, and we just get, you know, his priest son who doesn't do anything in the movie either. you can't help but think that was just a knock to Duvall, that he's just kind of an afterthought in the script. And
you about Apollonia, Michael's Sicilian wife, than you do about Tom. I mean, it's kind of absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's his brother. I mean, it's adopted.
He says it twice in this movie.
Yeah.
My brother, Tom. Yeah.
Yeah. And that loss doesn't mean anything to him. And he's still grieving. I mean, I get it. You know, Apollonia was the love of his life for about 2 weeks there. You know, at this point, 50 years ago. He's still jonesing for a girl that has been dead for a half a century, and his brother. Yeah. Oh yeah. I miss him. Yeah. Wish he was around. Oh,
all right. I do want to take a moment though, because you mentioned it right here that Apollonia, he thinks about her a lot, and they run the parallels when he's dancing with his daughter and he's thinking about her. Mm-hmm. And then they do have some of those nice flashbacks to the scenes in The Godfather Part II, where Fredo is killed. And to me, those were the great choices about this movie. They motivate the Michael Corleone character. Those are some of the things they actually got right, is that this is an older guy who's thinking about what he had to do to get to the position that he's in.
The opening shots of the ruins of their compound are amazing. And it, I'm like the movie starts out with such promise, because it's kind of like, you know, they treat it like they're sort of ancient ruins of Rome or something like that, you know, where this empire once stood. And I'm like, man, this really was leading up to something great. And then they just drop that ball.
Yeah, that is footage that they had shot for the original ending of Godfather 2.
Oh, well, that explains it.
Exactly. So it's like I agree with both of you in terms of how it works for storytelling, but also in my head it's like, yeah, it's maybe not the best thing to say that the best part about Godfather 3 are the flashbacks to Godfather 1.
The leftovers of 2.
The deleted scenes that show up. They're like, that's better than most of the new stuff you got. Give us that, Francis. But yeah, no, that was actually, and I believe that scene, those ruins show up at the end of the recut, the Godfather Saga cut.
Okay.
Which I still haven't seen, but I know it's a chronological edit of the first two films.
Oh wow, yeah.
So, but yeah, which is something I still haven't gotten around to see how that works. But yeah, I think if there's a lot of sins of this movie, but yeah, one of the first mortal sins is losing Tom Hagen and losing that character, replacing him with bland ass George Hamilton, who has like three lines of exposition and does nothing to contribute to the plot. And you know, what, when you take Tom out of the story, and I think that's maybe the biggest, the flaw of the film is like, even though I love the first two Godfather films, I can't really tell you the machinations of the mafia stuff that happens over the course of the film. Like, I can tell it in very vague details, but I can't remember all the bit players and who's talking to who and doing what, because what I remember about the first two movies is the family scenes,
right?
The family dynamic that exists. And this movie has like zero family dynamic except for like the new characters, because we only get a couple of scenes with Pacino and Keaton. We only get a couple of scenes of Pacino with Talia Shire, and he has no, like, he's got no more moral center. So it's just him wallowing in his.
Well, even the scenes with Talia Shire, I mean, there you got two of the great actors of the 70s and 80s right there. And they just don't do anything. I can't even describe what their relationship is throughout this movie.
Connie's become like an enabler, like in this time, like,
but in a weird way, she's become like Sunny Light. I don't understand.
I mean,
Talia Shire does great. I think this is like her best acting work almost from the three movies, because she has more to do than just, you know, whimper and cry. Mm-hmm. And because it's nice to see her be independent and take control. But yeah, I don't get what her motivation is. And she's totally obsessed with Vincent, with Andy Garcia's character.
Mm-hmm. But why? They didn't give us any of that. And then you have the mm-hmm. scenes with Kay are just as flat. I mean, it's not until the end of the movie that those scenes actually pick up steam, and they still don't give Diane Keaton anything to do in those. I mean, it's, which is a crying shame. Another great, great actress that is just given nothing to do because of the script here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The scenes with Keaton, though, I think are when I feel like Pacino is Michael Corleone again. There's a mm-hmm. softness to him in those scenes. It's not caricature like some other scenes. I think the two of them bring out the best in each other in their scenes together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing, is we have such a tie into these characters. Those are the characters we want to see.
Yeah.
Those are the characters, like, if you go to see Godfather 3, okay, I want to see the continuation of these characters. And we've killed off a lot of them. We didn't pay the money for one of the major ones, so, and then we underwrite the remaining ones. And so we spend a bulk of the film, like, with these new characters. And no one went to that movie being like, ooh, have you heard they've added Andy Garcia? I'm like, you know, no disrespect to him as an actor, but no, like, you're going for these characters and how they interact and how they've changed and grown and how this story's going to end for them. And honestly, it never really ends. There's no good ending for Kay's character.
Yeah.
You know,
no, and they don't have to be the center of this story. It's okay to turn it over to the next generation of characters, mm-hmm. but give them something to do, mm-hmm. a reason to be on screen. I mean, I guess we do see Connie, she gets more involved, and she's involved in the poisoning at the end. Mm-hmm. She does that great move that perfectly parallels the end of the opera where she puts the cape. Mm-hmm. So it's cool visuals, but we just didn't get the why for her at all. And she could have been a great character to bring out in the fourth one. You know, mm-hmm. she's running things at the mm-hmm. end of the show, but we just don't know any of that stuff. They left it all blank.
They try to bathe this movie so much in the lore of the first two movies mm-hmm. that I think they totally ignore what could have been great about this one, because there's so many little, they try and fill in so many Easter eggs from the first movie, you know, mm-hmm. It almost follows the first two movies down to, you know, a template almost, because it starts with a big party and then you've got Connie in there singing, you know, the tarantella, just like her mother did in the first mm-hmm. movie. And then you've got the father-daughter dance, and it just all keeps going down the line, and they try and just give a little nod and a wink to the audience. And this movie can't stand on its own without the other two.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they go off track with the idea of drawing the parallels between Michael Corleone and Vito Corleone, in the sense that Vito's kids want to be around him and want to be in the business. He's trying to shelter Michael from it, and Michael gets pulled in, which is kind of the great, you know, give and take of that film. In the third one, Michael's kids don't want, like, one doesn't want to go be anywhere near him. One doesn't really even seem to know much of anything that's going on with the family.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's talk about her. we've danced around this enough. Let's talk Sofia Coppola. So, backstory here is this role, the role of Mary Corleone, was supposed to go to several high-profile actresses. It was first offered to Julia Roberts, who turns it down to go do Pretty Woman. It then gets offered and filled by Winona Ryder. And I had always thought, I didn't know this till I did my research, I'd always thought that like she turned down the role so she could go do another movie. But she actually takes the role. But during the rehearsal or early shooting process, she has kind of an exhaustion breakdown, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, and this is where my age comes in handy, because I remember all of this. She was caught shoplifting, and that it was a huge scandal. She was at some high-end boutique store, walked out without paying for some clothes, and she
Wasn't that later? Wasn't that more like closer to 2000?
I think this was all around this time. Okay. And I could be wrong on the dates on that, but she went through a breakdown during this and had to go away.
Yeah. And so she backs out of the film at the last minute, and you know, so people are like, oh, so he grabs his daughter at the last minute. No, he had other options. There were multiple other actresses that were interested in the role. They had talked a little bit to Laura Sangiacomo. They had talked to Linda Fiorentino. They were talking to Annabella Ciora, who eventually, you know, she was probably a little older than they wanted. But eventually, Francis Ford Coppola makes the decision to cast his daughter, Sophia. Sophia's 19 years old and has only acted in very bit parts in films before. So of course she's the perfect person to make, to put at the center of this $1 million franchise, Oscar contender, sequel, follow-up to the two greatest American films of all time. What could go wrong?
All right, well, here's what could go right.
Okay.
Talia Shire and Nicolas Cage. I mean, they're Coppolas. So yeah. It happened before that he had actors in the family who are very successful.
I can't argue that logic.
Yeah. Here's what was really going on in my mind, though, is he didn't want to make this movie.
No.
But if I'm going to make this movie, I'm going to spend time with my 19-year-old daughter, and I'm going to stick her in this role. Mm-hmm. And we've gone through so many actresses, the studio can't say anything at this point. They just got to get it done.
Yeah,
so.
and I'm gonna give her a chance to become a major star.
Right, right.
I 100% co-signed that, because we're probably dance around this and hit and come back to it a whole bunch, but yeah, as we said from the top, Francis Ford Coppola did not want to make this movie.
No.
I think it shows in the final product, but so he figures, I'm going to get paid what I can get paid. I'm going to get the movie done. By the way, in Coppola's defense, Paramount did not do him a lot of favors in terms of their demands for the film. So they only gave him a year to write, shoot, edit the film. They basically, as soon as he agreed to do the movie, they're like, okay, you have 1 year. It's coming out on Christmas Day, 1990. It has to be done by then. So again, he's basically doing this with a gun to his head anyway.
Right.
So no, you're right. I 100% agree with you, Eric. I think it's like, if I'm going to do this, I might as well cast my daughter in it, get her a paycheck, spend some time with her. And if she's good, she becomes a massive star out of this.
The problem he did, though, was he set her up to fail.
Yeah.
The script ate her alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just going to say it, incest. You know, they're cousins.
Yes.
And you're going to put your daughter in that situation where she's going to sort of act with nuance and subtlety with that type of a situation, and it eat her alive.
Yeah, folks, if you haven't seen this movie, there's an incest subplot in this film, because her character of Mary, Michael Corleone's daughter, falls in love with Andy Garcia's character, Vincent, who is the son of Sonny Corleone. So yes, they're cousins and they fall in love and
they make gnocchi.
Yes. And Coppola, yeah. And Coppola casts his daughter to do that.
My thought is, you would think at some point when he is viewing dailies and he is seeing her in these scenes, at some point the smart filmmaker in him and the good father in him should have said, this is not going well and we need to make a heavy right turn.
No, they needed to pull an Eric Stoltz Back to the Future,
yeah,
and yank her out. But again, if they're under a time constraint, yeah. I mean, how much do they have to reshoot? Now, they also famously go in, and I didn't realize this. I found it in my research, but I had already made a note of it. The best that they could do for her was redub all of her lines, which do not look great on the Blu-ray. Like, it's like there is some clear ADR going on there. So not only is she giving a not great performance, it's a not great dubbed performance on top of that. And, you know, look, it has been really fashionable to like dunk on Sofia Coppola's acting. And I don't necessarily want to spend too much time doing that. She's a 19-year-old, she's a 19-year-old actress way in over her head in a role she never should have been in. She's gone on to become a great director and a writer. So all worked out. But man, like, yeah, you watch that and it's just like, holy cow. She, you know, she doesn't hold her own in any of her line delivery is awful. It's just bad.
And going back to his commentary that I listened to part of on the Blu-ray, he still, I think this was recorded in like the early 2000s, but even a decade later, he is praising how natural she is, because the character of, you know, this character would not be natural. And I'm like, if you wanted to go natural, cast a bunch of inexperienced actors. Do not throw your daughter in with these award-winning thespians who...
I like how natural is the buzzword we use for amateur.
Yeah.
Clerks features a
trained.
Bunch of
yeah, yes.
Clerks features a bunch of natural performers. They're not all good.
No.
And they're not all in a $64 million movie. They're in a $64,000 movie.
Right.
But yeah, so I could only draw it back to you, to what you said, Eric, because we need to talk about this just a little bit more. Even if you had Winona Ryder in this film, you still at the heart of it decide that one of your big story beats of this film is going to be an incest storyline between two cousins. Like, was that a thing in the 70s? Was that still socially acceptable?
No.
I don't believe so.
Because here's what baffles me about it. The only pushback that they get in the film is this is too dangerous. This will get Mary killed. It's not.
Which yeah. once at the end, when Kay comes to Michael and says, our daughter's in love. Mm-hmm. And I watching this time around too, I was like, does she know? She's got to know who this is that is talking about, because Pacino then turns to her and says, it's wrong and it's dangerous. That's the only time though it's said, but she knows it. How is she even an advocate for it then too? I mean, it's just that whole storyline blows my mind.
I think at one point Don Anabello, Eli Wallach's character, makes a comment about it too. I forget exactly in what context it is, but it's a seedy kind of comment too. But yeah, I don't even know. I'm not up on even like, you know, Italian culture and whether that was, you know, acceptable in like the old, you know, or whatever. But I can't. It's definitely not in 1979.
No, and in America, it's not like, there's laws against that, you know, this is none of that. I mean, now granted, I mean, this is not a family known for following the law, but I mean, still, yeah, it's so weird that's the tension of the center of the family tension. And there's so many different things you could do with Michael Corleone's kids, which ought to be really, and they ought to be the centerpiece of the film. you know, and the debate of maybe there's Sonny, but maybe Michael's holding out hope for his son or his daughter wanting to take over the family business, or maybe he's trying to get them all out and whatever, you know. And I don't know. There's way more things you could do but to land on incest is so baffling. And then to have the son like basically be written out after the first scene of the film.
Right.
They make it like it's going to be a big story point.
Yeah. And they don't. It's just like, you're going to be a lawyer. No, I want to be a singer. I don't want you to. Please. Okay. Because if we all know something about Michael Corleone, he gives in very quickly. It's just.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Yeah. It's such a. But and this is the other thing I want to dive in on, and I'm going to ask you guys this question, because I think a lot gets made of Sofia Coppola's performance. And watching this movie, I thought her performance provides cover for probably at least a half a dozen other mediocre to not great performances. And I'm going to start, because let's start. We haven't talked about some of these new characters. I don't think I like Joe Mantegna in this movie.
No, he's a lightweight. Yeah, and Joe Mantegna is a great actor.
Yeah.
But Joey Zaza is not intimidating. I don't. He gets his ear bitten. He's not.
And he either needs to be intimidating or a complete goof, right?
Yeah.
He either needs to be, Sonny, or he needs to be Fredo.
Yeah.
And he's neither. And it's like, and some of that's on the script, but some of it, I think, like Mantegna's line delivery in the movie, and maybe I've just listened, it's just years, maybe it's years of seeing him on The Simpsons or hearing him on The Simpsons.
He's got one of the greatest lines in the movie, though, when he's addressing the syndicate or the whole council. He says, if you do not give, I will take. That's it. I mean, I think that's his best line of the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't hate him in this. I mean, I do think the script didn't give him enough to do.
Yeah.
They kind of say the way the guy dresses, he's so flamboyant. He's no more flamboyant than the guys that are passing around the tray with jewelry on it and taking pieces off.
Yeah.
You know, make him look flamboyant. He'll act flamboyant, you know, but that didn't happen. You know, he is kind of supposed to be the guy, though, that is out in front of the press. So I think he is sort of playing this character that is palatable to the press. Mm-hmm. But I put that more squarely on the script than Joe Mantegna on it. And maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I just like the guy so much that I think he gives a fine performance. Nothing spectacular by any means, but I think he's okay in this.
Yeah, I think it's because I do, and I feel bad saying it because I do like him so much, but I was watching and I was like, I don't know if he knows what his character is or what he's supposed to be doing. And maybe that is an underwritten script or Coppola being distracted as a director. And maybe as we're talking this through, you know, I wonder if some of this is, you know, Coppola knowing that all the returnees know their characters incredibly well.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe because for whatever reason, maybe he's under directing a lot in this film.
Yeah.
Because I think he doesn't distinguish himself as a great performance. You know, we talked about George Hamilton not being great. We talked about Sofia Coppola being just flat out bad. The son doesn't get much to do. But then you get Andy Garcia, and I wasn't sold again on that, on that character. And I don't know what his it's a question of, is it the performance or is it the material or the direction?
Go ahead, Brandon, because this is a tough one. I want to spend some time on this.
My confusion with that character is he is the son of Sonny, and yet he gives off way more Michael vibes in his performance, and they never really make the distinction. You know, is he trying, you know, does he have Sonny's, you know, volatile, you know, or is he actually more Mike? You know, they never make that, you know, in the scene where the two of Zaza's henchmen come into his apartment, and you've got that little picture of Sonny behind him and everything. And I feel like they're trying to say, you know, he's now stepping into his father's role, but he's never really Sonny. He's always sort of more of the quiet killer in this. And I'm always confused by that character. I think Andy Garcia is great, and I think he could have been a great lead in this movie if they had given him the right material, but they cannot define who Vincent is.
Mm-mm. But he's great in that scene.
Yeah.
You know, he's showing his acting chops in that scene.
Yeah.
And I like that character is, it's completely disjointed from the way he's presented in the rest of the film. That character is sort of aggressive like Sonny, but he's also cunning like Michael.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you could have said, let's make this guy the best parts of those two characters.
Yeah.
I love too when, and it's a really strange decision. There's a couple of scenes before that when he's in the room with Joey Zaza. They bring them all together and he's yelling, and he's giving you everything, and you get these great reactions from Pacino, but you never see Garcia actually yelling. And it's just kind of a strange edit.
Yeah.
That he's not on camera for that at all. And it's like, he's the one doing the most acting here and you don't see him. So there's some strange things going on with how they're presenting him. And then the character is just kind of strangely written. He's supposed to be groomed and he eventually becomes the new godfather. But when's the moment? When does he prove that he can do all of this stuff, that he is the next Michael? And Michael just has this in love for him and just turns it over to him. It's very, very strange.
Yeah, that storyline amongst most of these storylines don't really track. Like, and because Michael's got like multiple subplots that he's going through. And so none of them like coalesce. And that's the biggest one, is that, you know, eventually he's got to hand over the business and it's like, again, it's like, I don't want you in here. Well, I want to be in here. Okay. Again, yeah. You know, he gets so resigned to things without much conflict that I agree with what both of you are saying. It's a character that should show more flashes. First of all, he does not look like James Caan's son at all.
Oh.
No, there's no family resemblance. And again, he looks more like a young Pacino than he does a young James Caan. Uh-huh. And he doesn't show those flashes. So it's just, and then you throw in, by the way, he's also the second half of that incest love story that we've got going on. So we have to watch him having romantic scenes with Sofia Coppola.
Well, not only that, but they have this disgusting mention of when he was 15, he was dating his 8-year-old cousin. I mean, instantly it's like, this guy's not likable. I don't want to root for this character, and you're going to make me do that.
Yeah.
So it's just a bad choice.
It is. And just for context, Andy Garcia, the actor, was 34 when this movie came out, and Sofia Coppola was 19. Mm-hmm. Yet again, ick.
Yeah.
Like, again, consenting adults, whatever, but dad's there, but I mean, it's so weird on so many levels.
I read a great review when Gene Siskel, who actually liked this movie when that came out, but he did say that Andy Garcia and Sofia Coppola had no chemistry and they don't feel like lovers. It feels like he's her babysitter.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that kind of explains it. He was probably trying to protect her from a lot of things. Hopefully, that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
The reviews of this from the time period are hilarious in retrospect, because everybody's kind of come around to, okay, this movie's not great, but it's one of those things where I think there was like a standoff between critics, because I don't think anybody wanted to come right out and say this movie was not good.
Yeah.
So if you read some of the poll quotes, you can kind of hear them like tap dancing around it while still giving it a good review. Because this is one of those movies that it's kind of felt like if you didn't like this, that meant there was something wrong with you. And then it took a while for us to all just collectively, like publicly admit this wasn't that good, was it?
Yeah.
But Dick Tracy, immediately.
Yeah. We were all on board with that.
Yeah. And the other one that disappointed me this time is you get a legend like Eli Wallach in this movie, mm-hmm. who could have been the next, this character could have been the next Hyman Roth, but he feels like, you know, your grandfather on a sitcom or something like that. I don't feel that character is ever as intimidating as he should be either. And Eli Wallach could certainly have carried that off if he had had the writing.
Right. Yeah. And all of these characters, all of, like some of those, that's the other part. The time gap doesn't help because there's so many times I've watched this movie and I'm like, am I supposed to remember him from the previous film?
Right.
And he's is a character that doesn't show up in the first two.
I know.
But they reference him being Connie's godfather.
Yeah,
so part of me is like, wait a minute, was he in the first two? Was his character in the first two movies? No, he wasn't. Because they bring back Don. Yeah, it's like, yeah. And then, because they also then do the same thing with Don Tomasino. They bring his character back, but it's played by a different actor.
Yeah.
Because the original actor passed away. So it's like sometimes they bring back characters, but don't, but recast them. They bring in new characters that like have this history that we don't know about. It's like, it feels like they got away with one in Godfather 2 when they had to recast Clemenza.
Right.
And they were like, well, we did it once, we can do it again, you know, where they rewrote Clemenza and turned him into Pantangeli. And it's like, okay, or not Pantangeli.
Yeah, that's right. Frank Pantangeli was Pantangeli, the New York boss. Yeah.
So I was like, they got away with it then. And then, so they're like, oh, we can do it again. And again, to go back to what you're saying, Flick, I don't think Coppola cared.
You know, he's like, I want to get this done. I'm going to want to get paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is. So before we move away from the cast a little bit, we did talk a little bit about Talia Shire and I didn't get a chance to talk. I think honestly, she's the of the returnees. She's the one that I think I really enjoyed and I still enjoy because I do think her character gets more of a backbone, but more than anything, I just feel for her because this is one of two sequels that she does that comes out during the holidays of 1990. And she basically reprises her main two roles and ends her run in those films. And neither one of them end up good. And the other being Rocky Five.
Was that five?
That was Rocky Five. Rocky Five comes out on Thanksgiving. Godfather Three comes out on Christmas.
Mm.
And that's the crazy. Fact it is crazy that she does both of those movies. And really it's kind of the end of her like run as a, you know, as an actress. I mean, I know she does other things after that, you know, here and there, but you know, those are her two biggest claims to fame. And both of them are just such whimpers of films for their franchises. It's crazy.
The one thing that got me about Connie this time around, and I know I've heard it before, but it got me where she's after Michael has done his confession and he goes back and she mentions Fredo drowning. I'm like, does she really believe that or is she just fooling herself here? Mm-hmm. You know, I think she seems to, like we said, we don't get much motivation for Connie in this. We just see her now all these years later, but I'm like, has she become such an enabler of Michael that she's just, you know, lying to herself about Fredo drowning here?
I mean, that'd be certainly something worth exploring in a better movie.
Well, and I do feel like that scene was her saying she's not lying to herself. She knows exactly what happened, but she's saying to Michael too, I know what you did. I don't really care. Mm. And that, you know, that does color her, that character a little bit more and show she's a little more vicious and that when she's called upon to kill someone herself, she's right there for it.
Yeah, because that is, and that's what I liked about the character. I liked the fact that she really, I mean, she's in on it. She's in on the final scene. And she, you know, she murders Eli Wallach's character.
Yeah.
And like she's part of the con. And it's kind of great. It's great, honestly. And I wish we get more. And that, and so that tracks that she would maybe she knows, but she doesn't care. And maybe in a better written scene, you would get more of that duality. But I like, I think I like that interpretation better than what I thought when I saw it, which was, Michael's kept that from her because he knows that, you know, he's lost Kay. He's lost his son, her son. He's lost his brothers. He's lost Tom. she's the only blood relative. Her and her daughter, his daughter, are the only two blood relatives he has left that want anything to do with him, which again would be really cool stuff to explore if they cared to do that.
Yeah. No, I think it's a missed opportunity there, especially with that character and that actress.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about some scenes. Are there any scenes in particular you want to talk about that stood out to you, good, bad, or indifferent? Eric, we'll start with you.
Yeah. And, you know, for as much guff as we give Sofia Coppola, I'm going to start at the end and say that when she realizes that she's been shot, that's actually a really good scene. You know, the last 3-4 minutes of this movie are really good. And it starts there. Everyone's reaction to that is heart-wrenching and amazing. And then that goes into the quiet ending that Michael Corleone has that parallels his father's own death too. I like that. That all worked for me. I wish the rest of the movie had started as good or as good as how it started and how it ended. It's just kind of that whole middle 2.5 hours. That's a little rough.
No, I agree with you. I really did find that last scene compelling, and it shows how remarkable it is considering how many issues I have with Mary's storyline and Sofia Coppola's performance that I cared when it happened.
Yeah.
And I would have, like you said, I would have loved to see even like an extra snippet of like her funeral or something, just to see. The one thing that I wish that scene had was, I know they're all, you know, everybody's shocked and crying on the steps when she died. So for those of you who haven't seen the film, so the big climactic moment of this film is an opera performance of Michael's son, who wants to be an opera singer. And that's also happens to be where all of these hits take, where they're taking out their enemies, a la the end of the first Godfather. But the big backfire is that they left one person alive. That person tries to kill Michael, bullet goes through him, kills Mary. And so Michael pays the ultimate price, which is the death of his daughter, which again, on paper, sounds great. The execution of it, really, really solid. Like you said, the middle, how we get there, not great. But I would have loved to see like some extra scene showing like the dissolution of his family, because I think what we're meant to believe at the end of the film is he dies alone, but how alone? Like, has the family abandoned him because of this? I don't know. And I guess that's left open to interpretation. But I would have loved to see and to get some more closure with the other characters, because we really, the only character we get closure on because of that is Michael.
I think that's on purpose. I think there was dollar signs and a Godfather 4, and they were like,
right.
And that may have been written, and somebody said, nope, we're not doing that. We may want to bring these guys back.
Yeah, that's true, because according to the timeline in the DVD, Michael Corleone doesn't die until 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this is happening in, by the end of the film, this spans 79 and 80, there's a nice 17-year gap where they're like, maybe we throw tens of millions of dollars, maybe we can get it. Yeah, I'd buy that.
Yeah.
Brandon, any thoughts on the final scene or the whole sequence there?
Yeah, that whole sequence leading up to it as well. I think the final, you know, the where you mix in the opera with all the killings, I think is really well done. We haven't talked about it yet, but I think the whole Vatican Bank storyline aspect of this is really intriguing. And the fact that they really based it off of a real life incident with the assassination of Pope John Paul I, it's fictionalized, you know, truth kind of. And that's something again, that had they actually explored more of it, would have been great. But yeah, I think the whole, you know, cuts to how, you know, the Pope gets assassinated, and then you have, you know, Al Neri, you know, shooting him on the stairs, and that shot of him being flung down, you know, and everything. It's, there is some great, great stuff in there. And I think there's some shots in there that are, you know, right, you know, with the baptism scene, you know, in the first movie almost. But like you said, you know, it's that whole middle section that, you know, doesn't quite live up to anything. But but yeah, I think the, you know, and of course, it, like you said, it all leads up to those final scenes on the stairs at the end. But I think Pacino, you know, is heart wrenching in that last bit, and the same with Diane Keaton. You know, like I said, unfortunately, we don't get much of Keaton in this movie, but they all, you know, really nail it at the end there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you bring it up. So yeah, we haven't even touched on one of the major subplots of the film, and actually, you know, what you think is going to be kind of the crux of the film, and it kind of is, but it kind of isn't, which again, another criticism of the film, is that, you know, the film starts with Michael wanting to atone for his sins. And I guess I'll go back to that question just in a minute. But so the whole plot is he is trying to get his family out of the business, and he is instead giving his money basically to the church. He's trying in many ways to kind of buy his absolution for all of his many, many sins. And so he ends up in this shady deal with the Vatican Bank, with this cardinal who is, later we find out, is essentially like using him and manipulating him, which I found interesting that in a movie about the mob, the real villains are the church. Yeah. As dirty, you know, Coppola's working through his faith, and when he's writing this, you know, he's like, it's as evil as the mafia is, man, maybe the church is just as bad, if not worse, according to this movie. But yeah, so the Vatican Bank is swindling Michael out of this deal, and then you know, we have Eli Wallach's character who's trying to get Michael, who's mad that Michael's basically pulling the Corleone family out and is trying to dissolve the syndicate. And it all coalesces in this big shootout where they're trying to take out all their enemies. So what do you think about this whole storyline? Because actually Pacino didn't like this choice of a storyline for Michael, in terms of he didn't believe that Michael would ever feel regret or remorse for his actions. And I was like, that seems kind of like a real sticking point if you're going to come back and do this movie, because that seems to be the crux of his character. What do you think about that choice of him, of Michael Corleone wanting absolution?
Yeah, well, so I think there's two different pieces there. And the first one is, would his character feel guilt, feel remorse? And they deliver that to us. And we kind of talked about that. He has these flashbacks of Fredo. And I don't think it's until he actually goes and meets the sort of John Paul the First character that he calls a true priest that he really feels that he wants absolution. I think what he's doing with his $100 million, he doesn't care about, he can't spend $100 million anymore. He's got that lying around. It's to throw it around, you know. And I don't think he cares about the award either, but it's something to do with the money. And so there's that piece of it. I don't think he's really doing that to get absolution. Would Michael Corleone invest $500 million in a international European-based conglomerate to legitimize his business? You bet your ass he would. He would, you know, he's not missing that trick. And he pressures the Vatican into taking a deal on it. So to me, that's not remorse. That's him saying, I'm getting in on this business, and I'll be one of the most powerful people in the world. My family would be one of the most powerful families in the world because we got this large chunk of this corporation.
Okay. Brandon, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I don't have any issues with him. I think that Godfather 2 leads up to him wanting absolution almost. I mean, just I think the seeds are planted even, but so that part doesn't bug me. And I think you're right, Eric, you know, him, you know, having no issues with the money and the church and all that stuff. It is stretching it for me a little bit that someone so wise to the world as Michael Corleone would get swindled by a cardinal who you would think doesn't have nearly the experience that Corleone has of swindling people. I think that for me is where you have to really sort of give in to the story and not think about it too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, that's the biggest sin. Maybe if there is a sin, the biggest sin of the film is going to be forgetting who Michael Corleone is. Uh-huh. Because he's a guy who gives up a lot of ground very easily. He doesn't, you know, he's easily duped and manipulated, and he's, you know, and I guess you could make the argument, I guess that's where I would differ a little bit, Eric, when I would say his desire, and there's, again, it's underwritten, but his desire to want absolution for Fredo allows him to get duped by the church.
Yeah, and I could see that. I could also see, and hey, movie, tell us, what is his motivation?
Yeah.
I could see, too, where his desire to go legitimate, mm-hmm. get out of all of the underworld dealings, moves him to want to take the deal and purchasing the stock in International Immobiliare. I guess the pieces that work for me too are, I guess it shouldn't make him naive though. So there's a piece that doesn't work where he says, the further up I climb, I realize the dirtier the people are. And it's like, mm-hmm. Michael Corleone would not fall for that. He would know, you know, and mm-hmm. he wants to be at the top, and he knows to get there, he's going to have to do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. But there's that other piece too, where he's got to deal with that syndicate. And one of the best things about the movie is that line where he says, I keep trying to get out and they keep pulling me back in. Mm-hmm. Some of that's outside of his control. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is a Michael Corleone that's fighting. He just can't figure out a way to leave that life behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just not well done. It's ham-fisted when they
it is. And that's actually the best part of the film. And I think if there's one memorable part of the film, it's that line. And, yeah. You know, and it is such a microcosm. That moment is really such a microcosm of this whole movie in the first place. And I think we said it earlier, but this, in many ways, this movie is an allegory to Francis Ford Coppola in real life.
Sure.
In that he wanted to get legitimate. He wanted to move away from gangster stuff. It didn't happen. He ended up getting roped back into The Godfather because of money. And he gets his money, but at the end of the day, his daughter suffers. it costs
it's a
him
sad, sad parallel.
It's a very sad parallel, but it's very true. Cause it's what it is. I mean, cause ultimately that's kind of what happened. That's what happens to both of them. And again, we keep going back to it, but the story that they have, like, conceptually makes sense in all of those things. The one thing that does not make sense, or at least feels, again, shoehorned in there, is Michael Corleone has diabetes in this.
Right, yeah.
And not till halfway through the movie. I mean,
halfway through the movie, he suffers like a diabetic stroke, which is way too soon after Steel Magnolias.
Right.
That's why Julia Roberts turned down the movie. Yeah.
Drink your juice, Michael. Drink your juice. Like, of all the things, what was it about, like, diabetic shock that seemed to be, like, so in the late 80s? Was that, again, like, another silent killer that I was too young to hear about? Or did they just, they wanted something like, well, we need to incapacitate him, but he needs to recover for the end.
And that scene in the kitchen, that's one of the kabuki theater scenes, mm-hmm. for me, when he goes into the diabetic shock. That's a little heavy. And what doesn't make sense is, you would think that his daughter's death at the end and the way he's reacting would have just killed him right there from what we've seen in the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. But he lives another 17 years.
Right.
Yeah. That's the other thing. He's managed to figure it out. And there's a theory that by the end of the film, he's blind, which is why he slowly puts on those like super dark sunglasses mm-hmm. at the end. I mean, if it's true or if it's not, I mean, mm-hmm. it's never really addressed. But yeah, like, and again, there's another thing that could have been something interesting. Like, he's looking at his own mortality. Now, granted, he's only 59 in this film, Michael Corleone's character. Right. So that's the other thing. It's like they're aging him maybe more than they should. Because even at 59, mm-hmm. you know, that's still relatively young. Even by 1979 standards that he's, right. you know. But I do like that idea of he's facing mortality and his legacy and what he's leaving behind. And maybe he's, you know, coming to terms with all the mistakes. You know, mm-hmm. they would do that far better later, you know, 30 years later with The Irishman. But it took them, they had to get the, you know, Scorsese had to see this and be like, okay, no, that's not how you do it. Let's try something new. But yeah, okay. Any other scenes or moments of the film before we move on to a couple of other things?
Well, the massacre of the syndicate is so operatically over the top. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, just the "my lucky coat" line alone. It's enough. I mean, and we get bloody massacres in the other two movies, but this one for me just feels cartoony. You know, we get, you know, Sonny's assassination is very over the top in the first movie, but it feels realistic. This one, mm-hmm. just, yeah, I don't know if it's just with the helicopter and everything, or it's how all these men are, you know, acting during the whole thing, but it just feels, it doesn't feel like it's The Godfather.
No, it feels it shows how much The Godfather, I mean, works of art always teeter a line, you know, there's, you know, perfection is hard. Yeah. You know, because calibrate too much or too little one way or the other, and it doesn't work. And this is a perfect example of it, because yeah, that is something that is perfectly in line with what the other two films do, uh-huh. but yet it comes off as a lot of this movie comes off as melodramatic.
Yeah.
And none of it's, you know, way too over the top. And some of it is the script or the directing. And I think some of it's just the passage of time. Is right. that in 1990, this movie, we're way past this style of acting. We're way past, you know, the concept of a Godfather film in 1990 feels kind mm-hmm. of dated. And Coppola doesn't update. He doesn't make a 1990 Godfather movie. He makes a 1970, this should have come out in 77 or 79.
Yeah.
And it would have fit the 70s style of filmmaking much better. Because the other part of that we didn't even talk about is the whole movie has a orange or gold sheen to it.
Yeah.
The whole movie's yeah. in this like sepia tone, uh-huh. as if we need to make George Hamilton even more orange. But like, it's so bizarre that it just looks odd. And so even like the gorgeous cinematography of the first two movies, it doesn't look as good.
No.
I wonder if that was a choice too. You know, from a 90s perspective, you probably only remember the burnt orange and avocado greens of the 70s. Mm. And so maybe he's trying to make it look that way, but it doesn't, none of the rest of the pieces seem to fit that, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, other than the leather jacket that Vincent is wearing at one point in the movie, there's nothing else that you'd point out and be like, oh, that's the 1970s. When you watch The Godfather, yeah. though, I mean, you know what the time period is when yeah. Robert De Niro's walking around. You know, when the first one, it's the, you know, late 30s, early 40s that they're, because of the cars that they're driving. You don't really get that for this movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. New York in 1979. I mean, that's the Studio 54 era, and there's no sign of that anywhere.
None at all. And that's an interesting idea. You know, the changing of the time, the changing mm-hmm. of the guard.
Cocaine would have been a huge thing with the gangster, you know.
I mean, they touch mm-hmm. on it ever so briefly, but that could have been a great plot point to have in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. How the world has changed around him and he needs to get out or whatever, or the, you know, people or things are passing him by. What all of those things like are just like left on the table in favor, you know, of diabetes and incest.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Was that the tagline for this one? I don't remember.
Godfather 3.
Diabetes and incest.
Diabetes and incest. Yeah.
And I do have to say that that whole gnocchi making scene is was cringeworthy the first time I saw it, and every time since then, I just it creeps me out. It's just poorly, poorly acted, and it's just it's bad.
It's wrong on so many. It's bad in a storyline perspective. It's bad in a real life perspective. It's just no. It's
no.
Yeah, there's this. That's their seduction scene, and I don't know. Are we supposed to want them to be together? Are we supposed to be like, ooh, this is forbidden. Things are, you know, oh, this is trouble now. Like, are we supposed to be like, or is their chemistry so supposed to be so undeniable that we're just like, oh, well, of course they're going to get together. Yeah. Look at the chemistry that's just radiating from Andy Garcia and Sofia Coppola.
I'm like, is that what Coppola wanted to be, the Demi Moore, Patrick Swayze ghost scene of this movie?
That was their pottery. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Pottery sales went up.
Yeah.
Gnocchi sales went down.
Yeah. All right. Well, and so for all the ragging that we've done on this movie, let's just set it at the top, 7 Academy Award nominations. It gets nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor for Andy Garcia, Original Song, Set Direction, Cinematography, and Editing. And I guess editing, it's the shortest of the 3 Godfather movies, so it does have that going for it. But, I mean, no Pacino nomination, nothing for the screenplay. You know, and it doesn't win any of those awards.
Right.
In fact, the other performance that Pacino gives that year gets nominated. That is Dick Tracy. He gets nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that, but not for Best Actor for this. And I'm frankly okay with it that year, because this ultimately loses to Dances with Wolves, but this also comes out the same year as Goodfellas. It's amazing. And I guess maybe that's, if you wanted a, like a better, like, tale of passing of the torch or of things passing filmmakers by, like that's a double feature that shows that it's insane those two are the same year.
Yeah.
Because one of those directors seems to know exactly what era they're directing for.
Well, and Scorsese's mom has a very brief cameo in Godfather 3, doesn't she? Because she's in Goodfellas playing Pesci's mom. Yeah. And I noticed that's the same actress. I think she's slapping Vincent's face or something like that in one of the scenes.
Yeah. So. Yeah, she is in 40% of the Best Picture nominees that year. So,
wow,
good for her. Yeah,
you know, you mentioned it way back at the top, Lou, that this felt like the Academy throwing a bone this way. It was kind of like the Lord of the Rings movies, except those probably should have won for some things and then won a bunch of awards. And it kind of felt that way with this. It's like, hey, we really loved those Godfather pictures and they've held up over time here. We're going to throw some nominations at this thing. And man, some of those looking back probably aren't deserved.
No, I mean, it would be crazy to me to think that this would be one of the top 5 films of 1990. I've covered quite a few films this year from 1990 for Guilty Pleasures, and I can say a couple of these are Gremlins 2, give that a Best Picture nomination. I'm good with that, but
he should have had Hulk Hogan in the middle of this movie.
Should have, that's what we needed.
And he and George Hamilton have a tan off, and then that would have been like pushed it over for me.
The bronzer budget alone would have driven this to 80 million. And they would, but the thing is, they wouldn't have needed the sheen on it. Everybody would just everybody else would just turn orange by proxy. So here's a question I want to ask you before we get to the last thing. So I know we've ragged on this movie for a little bit. So is Godfather Part 3 a bad movie, or is it just a bad Godfather movie? Like, do we dump on it so much? If this was just a movie, and I know it's kind of hard to divorce because the plot itself is so connected to the first two.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what I was just thinking about. If you had gone into this and you had not seen either of those two movies, you'd come out saying, what the hell was going on in that thing? I don't understand any of it. Bad movie, you know? You put it next to the other Godfather movies, it almost gets propped up a little bit because of that, because you know and like these characters so much. And then it's just the execution. So when you've got all the problems with the script that we've talked about, one actor in particular who got swallowed up by that script, and a director who seemingly just didn't care. I mean, looking back on it, you can almost tell that there are pieces of this. He's not directing anybody, and he just doesn't care. I got to put it squarely in the bad movie category because of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would go as far to say it's an average Godfather movie. It's a bad movie because of all the goodwill that was built up from the other two, that goodwill carries over to this movie. But if you were watching it on its own, there's too many fatal storytelling flaws in this movie. You don't get any motivation for any of the characters. There are too many Easter eggs built into the lore of the other two movies that you would have to be familiar with. There's an incest plot. there's just so much going wrong for it that to be able to view it, you have to have goodwill from the other two movies.
Okay. No, I think those are excellent points, because that's the one thing I've thought about is, do we just trash on it because by comparison to the other two, you know, it's so bad. It looks really bad by comparison. But I think you two make an excellent point of saying, you know, the goodwill of the first two movies really does give you nostalgia feeling. So when you do see it, because I felt that watching the movie was like, oh, it is still good to see these characters. It is still good to see Michael and Kay interact, and those flashbacks, you know, remind you of the film. So no, that's interesting. So yeah, we've talked about Coppola a lot, but what's interesting is, you know, at the time, I think he wants a do over. He would want a do over for this movie. I think in the moment, he didn't want to do this movie, and he spent a lot of his career afterwards either apologizing, backtracking, or kind of retconning Godfather 3. As you mentioned, Brandon, he never wanted to call this Godfather 3. He wanted to call this The Death of Michael Corleone. And he wanted to consider this like the coda or the epilogue to the first two,
hour epilogue.
Yeah. That's some PR nonsense bullshit, Mr. Coppola, please. And thank you. You make a good movie and a pretty decent wine, but come on. No, you don't make an entire film an epilogue. You want to make like a 45-minute short film to tie up loose ends. Okay, but this, no, you don't get to do that. This is Godfather 3. This is a full-length movie. It's as long as the other two. It's a little shorter, but still 3 hours. You don't get to do that. But what he does get to do, and one of the reasons we're covering this movie now in November instead of December, is Francis Ford Coppola has decided on the 30th anniversary of The Godfather Part 3 to go back and to try to fix some of the things that he feels were wrong about Godfather Part 3 and make a better cut. So on December the 8th, I believe, or December the 7th, we're getting the release of The Death of Michael Corleone, The Godfather Coda, is, I believe, the official title of that. It is not called The Godfather 3. So Scorsese, Coppola is getting his wish there. He is getting a actual recut of the film. And I know the film's supposed to be a little shorter, but he is claiming there's some unused footage. There's some new footage that he's going to add, and he's going to change some things around. And he also was promising a new ending to the film, which is ironic considering we all agree the ending isn't one of the big problems of the film. So before we take this to the guilt meter, I guess I'd say, what do you hope to see, or what do you think is possible with a Godfather 3 recut?
I don't, is there a way to remove the whole incest aspect of the plot? And I mean the whole build up to the final scene on the stairs is her confronting her father because he says she can't be with Vincent anymore. So I don't know how you would do that, but I don't know, because there's so many creaky things about the plot. I don't know that a few extra scenes or taking out a few scenes can fix it.
And, you know, we're classics. Typically, our films that we discuss have been vetted now through time, and they're considered a classic for a reason. Uh-huh. I haven't seen a bunch of these recut movies that have been, you know, far superior. You know, people talk about the Justice League, you know, the director's cut of that being better. I'm not an expert on that, but even like Blade Runner, I mean, there's some differences in that movie that make it different, but significantly better. I don't know that you can take a movie that you would grade a B and make it an A just by shifting some scenes around. And like Brandon said, there are some flaws that can't be fixed by that kind of manipulation.
Yeah, I would agree. I think unless we get to CGI Winona Ryder over Sophia Coppola,
it's already redubbed, right? Who
cares?
Yeah,
exactly. Why not? Or we get to use, you know, found footage. That they'll do the old Carrie Fisher to Robert Duvall in there, and wheedle some scenes in there. Yeah, I think the flaws of the movie are just baked into it. I don't know now. Have I already pre-ordered it? You bet your ass I have. Am I gonna watch it? Yep. Are we gonna come back here in a couple weeks and talk about it? Probably. So I guess what I'm hoping for is perhaps a version that I would be willing to watch more frequently than I'm willing to watch this version. Like, yeah. If we watch this version and it's like, okay, it's still not great, but it's more watchable and a little more satisfying than the original, I'll take that as a win, because then you could put it together. Now, I still think his whole retitling with the Godfather coda, the death of Michael Corleone, is still just some nonsense.
Because the connotation of the Godfather 3. I mean, that thing is radioactive now. He can't call it that.
Yeah, he can't. But I mean, it's just still, that's just some hubris on display there. That I don't think he'll ever get away from. But you know, he's spent the last year or so putting his foot in his mouth on a lot of things. So I guess he, you know, how he retitles his recut of The Godfather 3 is up to him. My other hope is, yeah, if there are some ways to cut out, like if they can cut out that gnocchi scene, yes. Great.
And I'm going to say this, and Brandon knows this, incest in and of itself doesn't necessarily make the movie bad. Chinatown.
True.
This movie's handling of it is the problem that we've got. You know, it's
well, and Chinatown is treated like the horror that it is.
Absolutely. mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's scandalous, and it ought to be, but it's not. Yeah, so. Yeah, maybe there's some way around that and they can make it work. But I'm intrigued. I'm not going to lie, because, you know, this movie's been getting dunked on for 30 years. And so for Coppola to even really want to open that wound again, I think is kind of interesting. And so part of me is like, is this his pride getting the better of him? And or does he really think he could do something with this? I don't know. But he keeps getting pulled back in, and we're not getting a Godfather 4. So I guess as long as he's going to do this, he can tinker with Godfather 3 all he wants, as long as he leaves the first two alone.
Yeah. Right.
So, all right. Well, let's wrap this up and take this to the guilt meter here on Guilty Pleasures on a scale of 1 to 5 shame spirals. 1 being you love this movie. It's a must watch. You think everybody should see this, all the way up to 5, meaning you either hate this movie, or if you do like this movie, you couldn't in good conscience recommend it to anybody. Where does The Godfather Part 3 fall on the guilt meter? Brandon, we'll start with you.
Man, I think I've got to give it a 3 because I think at heart we're all completists. And I think that even if, you know, like I know you've talked about with Rocky 5, even if you know it's bad, you've still got to finish the story when you know that there's more story to finish. And I think that there are enough good things in this that it is worth watching at least once. I'm not going to give it a rewatchable sort of quote. I would never recommend it to someone to watch it more than once, but I think in order to just, you know, complete the story, see, you know, a couple of good, you know, wrap ups to certain characters, I think that it's worth at least one viewing.
All right, Eric, how about you?
If you've seen 1 and 2 and you like those movies, it's a 1. You do have to go see this. You have to finish the story. You have to. It doesn't become a guilty pleasure at that point. I'm going to sit with Brandon at the 3 after that, though. If you go back to this for a second time, you should feel a little bit guilty. You know, there's some scenes that are worth rewatching, but the 2.5 hour investment ain't worth it. So I'd stick it in that 3 category then.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was right on the fence of 2.5 or 3, but I think you fine gentlemen have convinced me. It's Godfather 3. I'll give it a 3. Yeah.
Nice.
For the same reasons, I would say, and even for fans of The Godfather, I think it's a movie that maybe is worth revisiting once every, you know, 5 to 10 years. Just to be, you know, be mindful of it and remind yourself, okay, this is how the story ends. This is where it goes. And yeah, absolutely. If you've seen the first 2 movies, you should watch this and have your expectations good and low, because this is nowhere near the ballpark of those first 2 films. And to be fair, very few films are. You're talking about the second one is a miracle. It's so good. Like that's a miracle in and of itself. So the fact that they went to the well a third time and it doesn't quite work is not surprising. And the first 2 films are arguably 2 of the greatest films ever made. So yeah, there's going to be a drop off. The drop off's pretty steep, not going to lie, but it's worth checking out to complete the story. And maybe we'll be back in a couple of weeks to tell you that instead of this one, you should watch the recut or the coda as opposed to Godfather 3, which I'm intrigued by. But so maybe check this out now, and then you can check out the coda and see what all has changed. Or you can just wait till next month and hear it from us, because we are going to be back next month to review because Mr. Coppola would want me to say it this way. Mario Puzo's The Death of Mario Puzo's The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone.
Wow.
Forgive me that title didn't just roll off my tongue.
This doesn't give me hope that if he can't edit the title that well, it doesn't give me hope that the film's going to be better. I'm sorry. I haven't seen it yet, but
yeah. But maybe we'll get lucky. Now all it has to do is live up to Godfather 3. So it's already it's already getting graded on a curve.
I'm hoping it gets closer to Gremlins 2.
One can only hope. If he gets nutty with this, good for him. But all right. Yep. So yes, that is one of the things that we're going to be doing in the month of December for Guilty Pleasures. Also, we're heading straight into Christmas. You know, October has become known for Monster Cast at the Front Row. And the more holiday movies we just keep getting, the more I realize maybe Guilty Pleasures needs its version of Monster Cast, but just in Christmas. So we're going to open up a series of podcasts that I'm calling Slay What? Which is going to cover a series of Christmas movies that I'm sure are going to be just delightful for all Guilty Pleasures fans. We're starting off with a movie right off the bat. It's going to sounds like it's already got the potential to be an all-timer. The Netflix original movie, Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, which is her, Dolly Parton, Christine Baranski, 12 new original songs, full-blown musical, bring it on.
Sign me up.
Yeah, we're also going to be talking about the Netflix film Holidate. We're going to be talking Christmas Chronicles 2, possibly even Christmas Switch 2, and then who knows what else we're going to be throwing in. So we've got a lot of holiday films coming up, and I'm hoping maybe by the end of the year we also can squeeze in a little Xanadu. It's not a Christmas movie, but it's turning 40 this year, so we got to maybe work that one in if we can. So also coming up in December, you can hear me and maybe a couple of other familiar voices to do our Survivor simulation. For those of you who are jonesing for some Survivor, it's not going to be back this season, but we're going to be back and doing a special simulation of Survivor movie heroes versus villains, a simulated season where we pit 10 of Hollywood's most famous villains up against 10 of its greatest heroes. That's going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to that. How about you guys? What do you have going on for classics?
Oh, we are closing out the month of November with Noirvember, which is a celebration of film noir. And depending on when this drops, I bet our episode will already be out. But we're going to be interviewing Eddie Muller, who is a host on Turner Classic Movies. He's known as the Czar of Noir, and he is a film noir expert and author. He has written a book, countless books. He's a wealth of knowledge, and so we'll get to pick his brain about the film noir genre. And then Eric, you and I released a poll on our Front Row Classics Facebook page, and it looks like of the four film noirs that we gave people to choose from, The Big Sleep with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall is the one that's winning. So he and I will be recording that. And then in December, I thought about, we have discussed most of the great Christmas classics already. So we're going to do some madcap family comedies for December. And so Brett Rutherford's going to join us to talk about Auntie Mame from 1958. And then Jeremy is going to join us to talk about The Great Race from 1965. So some fun stuff coming up.
Excellent. Well, and for all of that content, you can find us on Facebook at the Front Row Network. You can also follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z, or also find our content on nprillinois.org under the Community Voices tab. I know Classics has its own thread that you can find wherever you get your podcasts. I've got my own thread, so if you want all those Christmas movies, make sure you find your way over to the Guilty Pleasures feed, because I can't clog up the main feed with all this garbage Christmas movies. So some of them are going to be feed exclusive. So if you want all of them, you got to subscribe over there. While you're there, rate, review us. If you give me a 5-star review and you request something in the review, I'll do it. Bring it on. 2021 is wide open, assuming it happens. I'll be ready to take on whatever you want to give me. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare. And let me know, what do you think of The Godfather Part 3? What do you think about the recut, the Coppola edit, or whatever we're calling it? I'm excited to hear. And also, we've got Oscar season coming up, so I know we've got some reviews of some new releases that are going to be coming out. So for all of that, just stay tuned, be dialed into us on social media. And if you're in the spirit, you can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe and become a patron and get the chance for some bonus content and also be a member of a show. Pick a show, be a guest on a show, all sorts of different tiers and options that give you more content and more interaction with all of the great people of the Front Row Network. So I hope you do that. Hope you're doing well. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holidays. Stay safe. Wear your damn mask. But until next time, for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Eric Flake.
I'm Brandon Davis.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.